Let's talk about that.
The Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services will now come to order. Today is March 5th, 2007. We would like to welcome Basic Right Oregon, who's visiting with us today. All of us probably have a constituent here or so, and now we're leaving as well, but we're glad to have you visit our committee today. Bye-bye. Today, as you know, we were scheduled to hear the Healthy Kids bill, and that was canceled. But I want you to know, and I want you to listen up well, those in radio land, TV land, across this capital, anything, anyplace else. The Healthy Kids Initiative is not dead. It will be heard. And it's just a matter of time that we can get into place, and it's appropriate to bring the bill back to this committee, and I'm looking forward to that time. So please know, the Healthy Kids Initiative is not dead, it's alive and well. Thank you very much. What I'd like to do today is to welcome the Public Health Department with us today, and Public Health Division, shall I say, and we will be hearing from, well, we'll hear first from Mr. Britton, actually, in introducing the bill, and then we will call our first persons to discuss the bill with us today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would you like to open a hearing on this?
Yes, I will. Hearing today on Senate Bill 5031, the Public Health Department. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to hand out the Legislative Fiscal Office analysis of the health services area within DHS, because the Public Health Division is part of that, and I'll do that right now.
Eric's coming.
Thanks.
You got it? Eric, we're much more efficient than we thought.
Thank you. And I want to point out a couple of things related to this analysis. The first thing is that you'll notice that in the governor's recommended budget for the 2007-09 biennium, we're looking at a total funds budget within the health services program area of about $6.1 billion. And immediately below the chart on the first page is another chart. It's a second chart that shows different areas within the program of health services. And the first one there is public health, special payments only. You'll notice that although it's a relatively small amount of general fund, 2% of the health services budget, 5% of total funds, that this is a very important program area. It includes all kinds of things that many of us may take for granted. Safe drinking water, vaccinations, licensing of radiation equipment in hospitals and doctors' offices, all kinds of things that are very important to our everyday lives to keep us healthy. The public health special payments only is discussed on pages 91 and following, but I also want to mention that the program support and central admin component of the health services budget, $302.5 million total funds, of that a significant portion is also devoted to public health, about $192 million of that 302 in program support and central admin is also public health, along with public health special payments. We are, as Chair Carter said, having a hearing on House Bill 5031. There are three other bills, however, that are related to public health that we will probably eventually hear in this subcommittee. That is House Bill 5032, which is a fee bill that we will be hearing next week along with a continuation of this hearing, and maybe further down the road, House Bill 2193, which is a fee bill related to, I think, tanning facilities. And maybe we'll hear more about that in the next couple of days. And House Bill 2187, which is related to fees for safe drinking water and the inspections that public health does of water systems. Anyway, you have the LFO analysis. The last thing I wanted to mention, Madam Chair, is that the agency will be mentioning or highlighting the performance measurements that are related to public health of the 29 Department of Human Services performance measurements. 9 of them are related to public health. So they even though it's a relatively small budget compared to the rest of this, there are a lot of performance measurements associated with this program area. With that, I turn it back to you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. In order to manage this as efficiently as possible, but at the same time, you having all of your questions answered, what we will try to do, and if I have to move on as a result of time, I hope you will forgive me in the first place. I don't see Dr. Goldberg. We might have somebody else here in his place, but I do see Dr. Allen and Dr. Grant Higginson, so will you join us? While you're coming, I want to also introduce one of my constituents who is very, very much engaged in hard work as an activist in North Northeast Portland, Mr. Darrell Mock, and I hope I said that right. He's with the organization of Brother to Brother and doing great work in the area of HIV and AIDS, and also organizing our community around other social issues that are important to us. Thank you for being here with us.
Dr. Allen. For the record, I'm Dr. Susan Allen. I'm the State Public Health Director. And Madam Chair, members of the committee, we're very pleased to be here. It was a little disappointing to find the reason that we were here this early was because of the deferral on the healthy kids, and I'm heartened to hear that we will be hearing more about that. It was rather late in the day that we found that we had a bit of extra time, so my apologies. We have two partner members on behalf of the Conference of Local Health Officials and on behalf of the EMS Promise System who are interested in presenting to you, but they were not able on such short notice to be here, so we'll be working to fit them in the other time frames that we have available to address you. I also, if you...
Dr. Allen, if you excuse me, with that in mind, that means we have quite a bit of time, so your questions would be appropriate in your time during the process.
And one more introduction, if I may. This is my first legislative session in Oregon, and this is my first budget presentation. So I certainly, I've learned a great deal about the programs in my time here and have enjoyed that and will consider myself able to answer most of your programmatic questions. The budget questions, I know something about, and I may on occasion turn to my deputy, Bill Coulon, for further depth and history that I can't bring to this. So I hope that will be all right.
Well, I'd like to welcome you to this committee. This is a very, very bright committee, and they are full of questions, but you have no reason to be disarmed in any way. There will be questions regarding your program. And if you have to call your deputy, that's okay, too. As a matter of fact, he can join you if you'd like for him to.
It'd be easier for him to take notes sitting back there.
Thank you. Thank you very much. You may proceed, Dr. Allen.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Dr. Bates.
Can I offer a little advice from doctor to doctor?
Yes.
You should introduce your staff and then leave the room.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, I'll take that under advisement for the future. Thank you. I appreciate the introduction about the types and scope of public health programs that Mr. Britton did at the beginning of this session. I think if you allow me to repeat some things that I've said in the past, public health is a health program that is about the health of the whole community and everyone in the community. Some of the things that we do look like medical care, but the reason we do them and how we do them is to have healthy people in healthy communities. So the whole scope of services that we have touches the lives of every single Oregonian every single day. Drinking water and food were mentioned. The WIC program, by the age of 5, 1 in 3 children in the state will have received nutrition services one way or another through our WIC program. Children's immunizations, every time a child goes to a school and does not have to worry about a measles outbreak, that's a public health success and a public health activity. It's a small portion of the DHS budget, and we'll go into some details in a moment, but within that portion we have over 100 services and program areas. So the scope of what we're going to be trying to cover in the next several days is extremely broad, everything from healthcare licensing, regulation of environmental hazards like radiation, food and water, direct services such as around TB treatment, AIDS testing, and vaccinations for children in school-based health centers. And that's just coming to say a few things about the broad scope of that. Public health's goal is to prevent illness and injury. That is cost-effective. It's often hard to measure what does not happen. So we're frequently challenged in trying to show the benefits of what we do when we say the drinking water outbreak did not happen or the children did not get measles. It's much harder to measure those than it is a number of the other things that are done. At the same time, the long-term studies of this have shown that public health and preventive measures are very cost-effective from a societal basis. They may or may not be able to be tracked, especially given the complexities of health care in the United States. You cannot always figure out where the savings actually benefited somebody else, an insurance company, 20 years later, potentially. But from a long-term cost-effectiveness, public health is very cost-effective in preventing illness and injuries. Having said all of that, I also need to raise a concern that the public health system in Oregon is not as strong as it should be. It's not as strong as the people in the communities in Oregon deserve it to be. And we will be highlighting, we have some programs, I think.
Dr. Reed, excuse me for a minute. I think this is a good time for everybody to look in your purses and in your pockets and see if you have a cell phone and turn it off right now, please. Just double check it to see if that's the case.
Senator Bates planted that phone. Let's be honest. You know, I saw him down there messing around.
Dropped in somebody's pocket. You know.
In Oregon, we have some programs that we can be very proud of that are as good as any public health programs in the country. Our laboratory, our communicable disease program at the state level, for example, are top-notch. We have too many programs that, for a variety of reasons, including long-term funding reductions or failing to keep up with increasing populations and others, are not really providing an adequate level of service or protection for the people in the communities that they're attempting to serve. But people who work in public health care very much about what they do, and they try to squeeze every little bit of effort and goodness out of the resources that they have. But in many areas and in many of our programs, we simply are not able to stretch full range. And you will hear examples from me later and also from the following presenters on the division over the following days. Our budget is somewhat complicated to explain in that among the wide range of programs that we have, some of them are fundamentally local programs where the state provides a framework and a technical assistance. And these would include a significant number of the maternal child health programs, for example, school-based health centers. Most of that funding goes through. We also have a number of programs where the state is the only provider. There is no local component. The radiation program, licensing of healthcare facilities, certificate of need, a few interesting programs we have, such as medical marijuana and death with dignity. Those are only at the state level. So some of the graphs that show a significant amount of funding retained at the state, we have a large number of programs where we are the direct provider across the whole state. Then we have quite a number of programs where there's a significant mix of state responsibility and local responsibility. The communicable disease program, for example, EMS trauma has significant local and state service providers, although the funding is not distributed exactly that way. Vital Records is a state and local partnership to a significant degree. And emergency preparedness, a very large part of the funding for that and of the activity related to that is in the communities. But we also have a very large state component around emergency preparedness. You can see that on the chart on page 6, where it refers to program support. That is our state staffing proportion, and it may look like it is rather large, but this includes, for example, our state public health laboratory, which is entirely funded out of this component. So in other areas of the department, I understand that has a somewhat different meaning as a category than it does with public health. In terms of our budget, as Mr. Britton had mentioned earlier, we're a very small part of the DHS budget overall, despite being such a large number of programs. We're about 4.2% of the overall DHS budget request. We also are very much federally funded. You can see that almost three-quarters of our budget is derived from federal grants and federal sources. So we are predominantly a federally funded and federally driven state public health and local public health system. The other funds, we have a significant number of programs, many of our regulatory programs, that are fee-funded and fee-managed. They live within the fees that they generate. And those, as I said, are primarily the regulatory programs. And the general fund proportion in the overall public health division in the proposed budget is 10% of the total funding for the division, and that's the proposal. You will see we have a significant number of policy option packages. In our current budget, the general funds from the state make up only about 7% of the funding that we have. The state funding for public health in Oregon, the part that comes both to the state and the local health departments, is in the lowest 5 of all states in the country. So this is a very, very small proportion of funding. Some of our office administrators participated in a National Public Health Leadership Institute and did a study on excellent state public health systems, and it was a good quantitative and qualitative assessment. What they found is that in those state systems that were deemed by the other states and their in-state peers to be excellent, typically the state proportion of funding is 20% to 28% of the overall budget. 3 to 4 times what it is as a proportion of funding. And the importance of that is not just that it is a matter of overall resources, but it's a matter of flexible resources to meet the state's need. Because the majority of our budget is federally driven, the federal government grants come with very, very tight restrictions on what must be done with them and how they can be used. So we end up with state and local public health programs that are packages of individual services with a challenge that we face to either address those things that are bigger issues in Oregon than they are in Washington, D.C. or Atlanta, where the CDC is, or in putting the pieces in between, the glue to stick them together to make them a coherent system. So the high dependence on the federal funding creates a fragmentation of our systems that we work very hard to avoid, but it is often working against the state expectations and requirements for those grants.
Doctor, one question. Because I can't help but notice the general fund portion versus federal funds and other funds that you get. Does that limit your efforts in terms of the kind of outreach work you do in communities locally?
Madam Chair, that is indeed one of the consequences. If we can get federal money for outreach on a very specific thing, such as HIV services, we can do this. But if it's a state-related, primarily a state issue, and there's no federal funding available, we have a challenge. I will mention in some of our priority areas, some of our efficiencies when I get to that in just a second. We've tried very hard to do some additional outreach, especially to ethnically and racially diverse populations and linguistically diverse populations, but we have no funding to do that. So it's been very, very marginal, very limited efforts.
Thank you.
The other challenge that we face that is very troubling right now with the federal money is that the federal funding in general is a bit of a roller coaster because it lurches from one year to the next, from program to program, and it's very hard to manage programs without some core stability. Nobody expects exactly the same dollar amount from year to year, but if 100% of your money is at risk from year to year, it makes it very hard to hire and maintain and really invest in a long-term investment. And a significant number of our programs are on the chopping block for a large portion or even 100% of the money almost every single year, including the Preventive Health Block Grant, which funds some of our critical programs for reaching out to local health departments and also to multicultural populations. That grant is again zeroed in the federal budget and is a great challenge. Our emergency preparedness money is expected to drop. Many of our other funding sources are expected to have significant decreases. We won't know what those are for some time, of course, but year after year we face the possibility of the federal money dropping drastically or even totally disappearing from some of our core programs. That also hinders us in building a system that has stability and that really can reach into the communities the way it should.
One other question. The full epidemic in terms of what was happening abroad, could we make a notice of intent to the federal government that we wanted to purchase some viral medicines in advance in case of some kind of a disaster?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we were provided the opportunity to purchase Tamiflu and another antiviral through the federal contract. What was offered through that was a match where we would pay 75% of the cost and the federal government would pick up 25% of the cost. We also will be getting, without our purchasing anything, a population proportionate share of the federal stockpile of those medications if there were an outbreak for which those medications would be relevant. We had significant internal and external discussions around the cost-benefit analysis of purchasing that and ended up purchasing a very small amount for what we are referring to as a first-strike capacity. If we had one isolated case of an atypical influenza that we needed to try to surround with protection and see if we could stop it, we've purchased enough to attempt that. The cost for purchasing the amount the federal government was recommending was $5.3 million. And in discussions with the medical community, with the Director of the Department of Human Services, and with the governor's office, it was determined that the cost-benefit did not justify it. The benefit is actually very little. I'm afraid the federal government and the media did not appropriately capture how little Tamiflu actually accomplishes in most cases. For the average patient, if you take it once you're sick, there's another way to use it, but the federal government was pushing that you take it after you've been exposed or at the first sign of symptoms. On average, it reduces your illness by a day and a half. And there's no evidence that it actually saves lives in people who are at the highest risk and seriously ill. There's anecdotal but not solid evidence. There are also almost 20% of the viruses out there it doesn't work with anyway. So while, if you could do everything, we probably would have bought it because we couldn't do everything, and we thought that investing in having nurses in the community, having education, and the fact that we are prepared to distribute the federal amount if that becomes necessary, it was not purchased. That was a rather long answer, I'm afraid, but I know that's a topic that has been of concern to some people.
Thank you.
So. With respect to our efforts to quality and efficiency efforts, the doing more with less is almost a public health byword across the country as well as here in Oregon, because people are so committed to trying to address emerging needs with existing funding. We have, as some of you may be aware, I'm not only new to the state of Oregon in this capacity, but also this reinstated having a public health division where all of our public health programs are now connected together in a kind of identified substructure within the Department of Human Services. We've worked very hard at establishing those cross-program connections. I think that even without additional funding, that you have a lot of benefit when you have people who, from several different program areas, who are worried about toxic exposures for children or are worried about foodborne outbreaks from an epidemiology and an environmental health perspective. So we've worked very hard to have those programs coordinate even more effectively than they previously had, and do active joint planning and prioritizing across the whole public health system. We believe that has brought some efficiencies and improvements. We've done the same thing with the local health department. The local health department, health departments are very strong and important component of the service delivery that we do. There are 34 of them, most of them single counties. Wasco Shurian's a joint, and then Gillum County has no local health department. That's services for them. A combination of their neighbors and state services, but 34 local health departments do a very, very important amount of work. And we did joint planning around prioritization for programs and future directions with them in a way that I think has brought a lot of alignment of what their efforts and ours have been.
Representative Nixon.
Thank you. You mentioned a strong partnership with the local health departments. We know that there is a very likely crisis at the county level due to loss of federal funds. Is this a topic that you will be addressing at some point in your discussions with us, or would you like to comment now very briefly on whether you think that there's a potential impact on public health services as this impending crisis develops?
Madam Chair, Representative Nathanson, we've been very concerned about that, and I think the media have shown that a number of counties have said that some of their first and most drastic cuts may be their local public health services. I've been contacted by newspapers and by some county commissioners from around the state. We have, at the state level, a couple counties said they would totally close, that one of their considerations was potentially even closing the local health department, which we will do everything we can endeavor to do to make sure there's still a local piece of public health that needs to be. But because we felt a responsibility to be able to respond promptly, you can't hold up for 30 days on doing an outbreak investigation, and you can't hold up for 30 days on making sure that family planning services are available. You get a different consequence for those delays. So we had at the state level about a month ago now a retreat where we came together to do an almost all-day planning process to identify what our fallback responses would be if needed. So that's one piece of it. I hope it won't happen. We also, on Monday of this week, had an all-day planning session with the local health department leadership along with the state public health leadership to examine what we think the full array of options would be if we're unfortunate enough to have really significant cuts. Because nobody knows exactly what the dollar amounts will be or what which choices individual counties will make, we thought that the best we could do at this point was have an array of options at our fingertips and make sure that the states and the locals were working very closely together around this. And meanwhile, we recognize also that that impact is much more than just public health, and it sort of needs to stand in its own right. So we've actually tried to pursue the discussion about needing to improve public health in some core areas, even knowing that we also have this other conversation that we may have to pick up some pieces or do some stopgap measures at the same time. I'm not at this point going to be able to put the two together, but I will acknowledge to you we're worried about it very much, and we're trying to pursue both lines, because the stronger we can make the system, then in the the better the system as a whole, including neighboring counties and everyone else, will be to respond.
A brief follow-up.
Please.
Madam Chair, I am very concerned to hear this and to hear about the implications on public health, not only in those individual communities or counties, but also the state interest for whether it's disease or some other aspect that may have broader implications. It's no longer just about what an individual county may or may not be able to do, but I think we have a state interest to pay attention to this. So I hope that we can continue to stay on top of this and see what we can do to help the situation. Thank you.
I think it's a good policy decision, and certainly we will have a chance to have to deliberate on that, please.
Thank you. A couple other things that we have done that address quality and efficiency efforts. I mentioned a few minutes ago that while we are not directly funded for translation and for multi-community outreach, we have pulled together interested and talented staff from our various programs into a number of ad hoc efforts. We now have bilingual signage in the Portland State Office Building. We have developed, on behalf of the state government, the first Spanish-English glossary of governmental and health and public health terms that we are using to begin standardizing and ensuring the quality of any of the translations that we're doing. Many routine documents were being translated, but there was no state capacity for doing urgent translation of an important media release related to a health crisis or a health warning of some sort. We have created a contract for that, which we have now tested, so that within 2 to 4 hours we could get initially bilingual but ultimately multilingual translations for urgent press releases as well. These are the contracts that we're hoping that the Department of Human Services and other aspects of the state government will be able to adopt once they see that we've piloted these. But we've done all of this, again, with ad hoc committees created from a range of program staff and with no funding for any of these activities at the moment. We also are recognizing public health is very much about teaching people, helping people, giving people information. And we produce some excellent materials in-house that we're getting limited distribution. So we also created internally with Tim Cup and a nickel here and there from different grant programs which had a communication or health education component, a pilot project for communication outreach, not just media, but active outreach and communication efforts, so that the materials that were already being produced could get a much, much wider distribution into medical offices. We now have a standing column in the Department of Education's newsletter that goes out to all the educational institutions. The Oregon Medical Association includes a public health column in everything that we're doing. We're getting out into community health centers with our displays and materials and in many other ways, making sure that those things that we do produce get the maximum value and exposure, again, without any significant addition in cost. Those are just a few of many things, and you will hear others as individual programs come up later.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon, Dr. Allen. I am hoping that at some point in your presentation, if not today, but later, that you will give us some more detail about the ad hoc efforts that you've described around providing translation and interpretation services. Again, acknowledging that the efforts are ad hoc, fragmented, no funding for them. It would be very good to hear on record what are you recommending? Is the department recommending something that will move us beyond, advance us beyond our ad hoc efforts, recognizing that we've had demographic shifts in our state? We have Russian-speaking people and different Asian languages, and et cetera, and on and on. So we have to be able to get beyond the ad hoc, and I'm hoping that you're going to bring forward a recommendation that tells us how we address these needs in a 21st century way, as opposed to a patchwork quilt of doing something here, something there, and we hope it all works.
And Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I'm not going to have a proposal that goes quite as far as what you were just inviting, but just to jump ahead briefly, as I mentioned earlier, we have a significant number of policy option packages, and as we were sorting through our priorities for what to bring forward around policy option packages, a very considerable number of them address health disparities in a range of populations. We don't at this point have a specific proposal for the linguistic aspects of that. And I also believe that when James Mason presents on some of the work that the Office for Multicultural Health has been doing, he may hit some additional details. We would be glad at the end of all these sessions, if you have remaining questions, to provide you more detail on our efforts.
Great. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
The challenges that are stressing our budget, Senator Gordley just mentioned the increasing diversity of our population in many ways. And we look at health disparities and we recognize there's the racial, ethnic, linguistic. There's also the increasing numbers of uninsured. That's a health disparities issue. And rural, I visited all the local health departments in my first bit of time here. And many, as you get out into the more distant and remote parts of the state, the struggle for providing services or obtaining services are considerable. And if you look at the health disparities, they have poorer health status as a result of many things. So there are a significant number of issues related to health disparities that we believe are challenging us and driving some of the efforts to identify where we need to be moving ahead. There's an increasing number of regulated establishments. We do regulation, hospitals, health systems, restaurants, drinking water systems, radiation devices. The numbers of those are growing, and the staffing and resources for inspecting them have not in all cases kept up with that. The concern about emergencies has been a very, very big issue for us. After the office, you know, in addition to the Office of Emergency, Oregon Office of Emergency Management, we are, public health is the other sort of lead agency in emergency planning. We have done some things. We've made some advances. There are things that are hard to do without more of the state investment in this. And there are certainly, the work is begun but hardly completed. Oregon did not have a strong foundation for this in health and medical arena. We have a long way to go and consider that one of our budget challenges to sustain and complete the work that we've started there. We have a number of key programs that had lost ground. We, at one point, had an excellent tobacco prevention program in the state that could demonstrate the successes of the interventions. The program has lost ground, and those successes have eroded significantly. Our environmental health programs, at one point, were quite good, and they have lost ground. Our drinking water system and our radiation programs, which at one point were given accolades following federal reviews, are now being found inadequate, and we're being given remediation requirements by the federal reviews. And they're correct. It's not that they're just being picky. Their issues are right, and their issues are not about the competence of our staff. They're simply numbers of resources. We are late in responding to complaints. We are late in doing the number of routine inspections that are required. Staff in some of these programs end up having to make a choice. Do they do a scheduled investigation, or do they respond to a complaint? They can't do both. We also, I mentioned the threats to federal funding, which are very worrisome, and the narrowing flexibility of federal funding. Emergency preparedness money has gotten tighter and more restrictive and proscriptive in how we can use it. And while, again, we're trying to do the best we can with that, we think that that's going to happen. So not only is it getting less, but it's getting harder to use it in multiple ways. The overall we hope that the expectations of the people of Oregon on behalf of what they think they should be getting from their public health systems is also increasing. We're trying to help it increase. And as people look to make sure that we're there to provide the services that they need, they will be identifying gaps themselves, I'm afraid. With respect to the policy option packages, we focused on what are fundamental public health programs. In our large array of programs, we have many of them that are somewhat more peripheral to the core things. So we specifically said, what are the most basic, most important things we do that need to be brought up to a higher standard? And they were organized around two major themes: improving our ability to protect people and addressing the issues of health disparities. And in one way or another, some of them do both. But you will see that we have, we're especially interested in the ability to have local and state capacity to deal not only with a big event like a major earthquake or like a pandemic influenza, but even those norovirus outbreaks that happen in a nursing home or a daycare, or the whooping cough outbreak that went on for months and months in a couple of our communities. Even just outbreaks of those sizes right now challenge the local health departments to respond to them and tie them up for weeks and weeks and have them closing down other services that they provide in order to be able to respond to this urgent need that's in their community. Some of these core capacity issues, the ability to protect people, that you will be hearing our program policy option packages on, include our core capacity emergency preparedness, drinking water, radiation, and emergency medical system, trauma system. In addressing health disparities, you will hear policy option packages on dental sealants for children, school-based health centers, WIC farmers market, which also benefits farmers, family planning, Oregon Healthy Teen Survey, so that we can collect the data that tells us what's happening with our teenagers and so we can monitor if the things we're trying to do to make it better are working. Tobacco and health disparities issues related to drinking water and EMS as well. I also wanted to note that many public health programs support economic benefit in the community, that our radiation program is the final inspection site for a large part of the U.S.'s business in exported grain. If we cannot promptly certify that the grain is radiation-free, then it backs up and costs all across the country, as well as the grain exports from the state. Businesses count on safe and clean drinking water. One of the major differences between doing business in Central America and doing it in the United States is that you don't have to create your own water purification system if you're a business trying to do those kinds of work. So there's very significant economic and commercial benefits to maintaining the safety of our communities and our community-wide safety. We're hoping that this year will be the opportunity for Oregon to determine the kind of public health system that Oregon wants and deserves and put an Oregon stamp on it, not just a federal stamp.
Question?
Thank you. I'm also addressing the first section, the Office of the State Public Health Director, which is the office that I am in. And the deputy, it includes three program areas. This is on page 13. Three program areas that cut across all of our public health programs. So we focus on policy and on creating a coherent, connected system and overseeing the administration and management. The three program areas that are within the Office of the State Public Health Director are public health emergency preparedness, the community liaison, and then program operations, which is an administrative unit. As you can see on page 14, the three-quarters of the funding for this office is also federal money. And in fact, the general fund, that just as a reminder, which I needed to remind myself, the $10.5 million that's there in general funds includes the policy option packages. So without that, we have approximately half this much in this program. And almost all of that is funding that goes to the local health departments directly as their per capita amount. So just, I looked at that and was trying to remember where the $10 million was. Well, it isn't. It's actually $5 currently. So the proposal we have with policy option package would bring it up to $10 million in this field. 85%, if you look at the bottom chart here, you can see 85% of the funding in this program area goes to local health departments. So this is very substantially pushing it out so that the communities can do what they need to connect with our system. Our major sources of funding are the two federal emergency preparedness grants, the preventive health block grant, which is currently proposed for $0 in the federal budget, and then also the general fund is primarily what's referred to as the per capita funding for local health departments, which is distributed to them and is their only sort of flexible funding outside of the categorical areas that get pushed through to them. A public health emergency preparedness program has no state money. It's entirely federally driven program. And the two grants focus on state and local public health planning and hospital and health system planning. I can say a good deal more about that, but given that it's federal money, the primary thing to say is that we do have contracts with this money, with the local health departments and also the tribes, to make sure that emergency preparedness is covered. They will be very hurt if the federal money is restricted and we have no other capacity for that. We have heard rumors of a 12 to 16% cut, but no one has firm numbers on what that might turn out to be. The benefits of this are for every person in the state of Oregon as we help every community be prepared. The community liaison program, which starts on page 21, is especially important, although it's small. This is the strongest focus for support for local health departments, for technical support, for creating, helping the local health departments create a statewide local public health system, for the ongoing professional coaching, and also for the monitoring and quality assessments that we assist the local health departments in doing. This is a small, vital program that is 100% funded by the Preventive Health Block Grant, which is currently being zeroed out. Without this program, it would be extremely difficult for us to maintain our partnerships with the local health departments. And then policy option package, I would like to call your attention to. Support local health departments in emergency preparedness and core capacity. This is our modest first step proposal in increasing the ability of local health departments and the state system to be able to respond to those norovirus outbreaks, to make sure that there's continuity of services and some flexibility of services at the local level. The current amount of local funding on the per capita is 58 cents. Per person. 58 cents per person is what the local health departments are currently getting. This modest proposal is to essentially double that. And in addition, to add about six state staff who would be focusing primarily on supporting local public health activities and efforts. The per capita funding has held steady over time.
Excuse me, Dr. Allen, I apologize. I have to interrupt. We've been called to the floor for session. We may be back.
There'll still be senators.
Senators are still here.
We'll be carrying the ball.
Capable staff.
Hopefully we'll be right. Get your act together a little.
You apologize.
I fear for Senator Gridley.
She is now, as an independent member of the Senate, she now has an equal vote to this committee.
Representative Bill has just informed me that I can do whatever I want. So.
Well, Madam Chair, I am pleased to be here on this occasion.
Please continue.
And I also recognize that we all have jobs to do, and this is their job, and I'll continue to do mine to the best of my ability. I was just wrapping up the discussion of our policy option package for essentially doubling the capacity for local public health, separate from the discussion we had around the timber funds, and we are trying to separate those two discussions, recognizing that this could end up being a drop in the bucket for a different set of needs which have to be addressed at a different time and place. Nonetheless, we believe that this would be an important step in the right direction and would contribute significantly to improving the capacity and the quality of local public health and therefore state health.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bates.
Thank you. Your policy packages, do any of those leverage federal funds?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, a few of them, it varies greatly. This one certainly does not. But we have the family planning one leverages at an impressive 1-9 for some portion of it. The small amount of the drinking water leverages at 50-50, but it's a fairly modest amount. Let me just double check. Are we leveraging?
And school based health centers may be able to be entitled to an administrative.
School-based health centers may be entitled to an administrative match.
Yeah, I'll check with LFO on that. It'll be good to know that.
Okay.
Help us considering those. We'll find out.
I'm completed, having taken a good deal of time, and I would like to, assuming that the committee is still interested in proceeding, Grant Higginson is here to talk about the EMS trauma and other programs in his office.
Very good. Let's move forward.
Yes. I'd like to go back to the amount of money that's flowing through to the local counties from the state program to give us sort of an idea of what that's going to look like when the O&C funds go away. That was quick. A great deal of the money as you receive, you flow back down to local communities in your local departments. Do you have any idea what part of those budgets that is? Have you ever looked at it from the point of view of, you know, total budgets that the counties have from county funds and then funds that the state supplies through the Department of Health?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, I've got two pieces of information that I hope will be helpful. One is that if you figure all of the funding that gets pushed through to the locals, between the federal and the state, it's, we're the provider of about 80% or close to 80% of what they have in one way. And that would include the fees that they generate under state authorized programs. I'm sorry, I misstated that slightly. We looked at how much of their funding comes from the counties currently, county general funds, because we thought that was the amount that was vulnerable in these retreats I mentioned that we had with CLO. And it averages between 20% and 30%, although it varies very, very greatly. But it averages for the whole local public health system between 20% and 30% of their current budget is from state general fund. So it's a significant reduction. In terms of state general funds to them individually across all of our programs, because it goes to some of them as part of a match for other programs where it's a mix of state and federal money going through, they get about $13 per capita total from all of the sort of state-related resources that we push through to them.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
You may.
I'm still a little confused, and then we'll talk about it later. What I'm trying to find out, we've done this in other areas, county by county, is how much of state and federal funds are flowing to those counties in the public health programs, and then with each county, because some counties put some in, some don't.
Yes.
I would expect, I'm just guessing. It's not the same every county. I like to see how it affects some of the O&C counties who may be putting a lot of local money in or may not, and it would help us to know that.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, we do have a spreadsheet that shows county by county. There's only one county that puts no local funds in, and the average, as I said, across the system was 20% to 30% of their budget is local funds, which is the part that's vulnerable if the O&C monies go. But we will provide you that spreadsheet.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, your time is over. Dr. Higginson. So did the house come back?
We're not till 3 now.
Okay. We got our exercise.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Madam Chair, excuse me, Dr. Higginson, Representative Cortez.
Thank you. And I'm sorry if I missed this, but is there a report that shows how we're spending all of our federal terrorism dollars, that are going into the department? Are we required by the federal government to produce a report that we're spending it here, there, and everywhere? I'm just curious.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, we're required by federal government to produce a volume of reporting on emergency preparedness grants that you would hardly believe. So any possible detail...
Reader's Digest version, if you find it.
Well, I'm not sure. I'll have to consider if we have a Reader's Digest version, but we certainly can. We have short budgets, and then we have detailed budgets county by county, so we can try to do some roll-ups that might be helpful, if that's what you're requesting.
Yeah, and thank you. I just wanted to get a sense, because I know when all that money started coming from the federal government, there was a lot of question about where it was going. I'm sure it's all going to the right places. I just was curious what it's being spent on. And I saw it as a boon to supporting our public health system, so I'm assuming that's where most of it's going, which is great. So if you have any brief, I don't think you need to give me a long summary, but just general categories of where the money's going would be helpful. Thank you.
Chair Carter and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson, and I'm the administrator for the Office of Community Health and Health Planning, State Public Health Division, Department of Human Services. And Dr. Allen, in her presentation, mentioned a couple of times how important local health departments are as one of our key partners, and they are critical. I mean, it's really where the rubber hits the road at the local level when it comes to the delivery of public health services. But another key partner that we have is the healthcare community, and that's where my office comes in. My office is one of the critical connections between public health and the healthcare community. There are four major program areas.
Dr. Allen, just mention to the committee that we are on page 25.
There are four major programs, and as Senator Carter said, the descriptions start on page 25. I'm going to go through these very briefly and then spend more time on a couple program areas when we're talking about policy option packages. Emergency medical services and trauma systems, there we license all ambulance agencies. We also certify all emergency medical technicians and first responders. Because of those responsibilities, we're also the disciplinary agency for those agencies and providers.
So let me ask one question. So if your budget is cut at all in terms of local support, then the ambulance service and all this other kind of stuff would be affected by that.
I'm sorry, Senator Carter, can you repeat the question?
If your budget were cut at all, what would be the impact of ambulance service and those kind of things on your budget?
Right, Chair Carter, the actual provision of ambulance services is a county responsibility, so it's the county that's responsible for contracting with an ambulance agency. What we would not be able to do is provide them with the same kind of support that we're currently able to provide them, and if it got too bad, we would not even be able to license those providers.
Right, I just wanted to commit to hear that.
We are not just a disciplinary agency, however. We also provide training, and one of the programs we do is have a mobile training unit where we have two ambulances that go out and actually provide training to EMTs, primarily in rural and frontier areas. And also in that program, we manage a trauma system, a collaborative effort of 45 hospitals across the state to make sure that those individuals who are critically injured get the right level of care as quickly as possible. The second program in my office is health systems planning, and it has two major focuses. The first one is access to care. We are the people who make the health care designations of medically underserved or health manpower shortage areas, and this is important for communities getting resources. We're directly involved in the placement of health care providers, including the J-1 visa program that allows foreign physicians to stay in the United States and practice in underserved areas after their residency. We also do a lot in the way of community support in that program and have worked with a number of communities to help them with an application for federally qualified health centers and the placement of other providers. And this, I think, is critical because a lot of these services are providing access to health care for the most vulnerable Oregonians. The second major focus area for this program is on patient safety, and there it's primarily working with the Oregon Patient Safety Commission. The third area in my office is healthcare licensing and certification. We license or certify a wide variety of facilities and agencies, hospitals, ambulatory surgical centers, dialysis centers, just to name a few. We actually license or certify over 500 agencies. While it's important just for access to care in general, it's also extremely important that we have some assurance that the care that's being provided is safe and of high quality, and that's what this office is meant to do. We also have a primary responsibility to follow up on any complaints that are lodged against any of the agencies or facilities that we license and certify. And then the final of the four programs in my office is the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program, and I would remind people that this program is really not our idea. After it was passed in 1998, responsibilities were given to us primarily for a registration system, and currently there are over 15,000 people on the medical marijuana program. As I said, I will spend some time talking more in detail about a couple of programs, but just wanted to go over. Chair Carter,
he's just really, really trying to get you unfocused back to him.
I didn't even have a question. I mean, he's talking. Yeah, I didn't do a thing.
Your gyrations. I'm looking at it.
I was wondering if he was one of the card holders. That's what I was wondering.
Chair Carter and Senator Westland, that is against our confidentiality to get out that kind of information.
You're going to try it and do it pretty quick.
I tried to get one, but the governor wouldn't sign my card, so I didn't.
Thank you.
Okay, so I will go into detail on a couple of programs, but just first a few things in general. Where service recipients are located, all of the programs in my office serve statewide constituencies. Who receives the services? The direct recipients are healthcare facilities, agencies, providers, and for medical marijuana, actual patients. How are services delivered? We provide that in a number of ways. Many of our certification and licensing functions are performed in the office. We also do on-site inspections and complaint investigations. We provide a lot in the way of technical assistance and consultation, both by the phone and on site. A lot of times, particularly when we're working on access issues, we are out in the field working collaboratively with partners. And as I mentioned, through our mobile training units, we are providing education and training out in the field. And why are these services significant to Oregonians? While the direct recipients, as I mentioned, are primarily healthcare providers, agencies, facilities, it's really all Oregonians who benefit from these services. As I mentioned, primarily those that are most vulnerable when we're talking about access to care issues and safety issues. But also, I think it's important that everyone who's treated in the hospital or seen by an ambulance service or healthcare facilities, that they have assurance that there is some standard of high quality of care. I now want to move on quickly to the budget summary, and this is on page 6. And as you can see in the governor's recommended budget, the office has a budget of $19.7 million. As with most of the other programs, we are low in general fund, about 12% in general fund. 45% of our budget comes from other funds, primarily fees, and then 43% in federal funds. So as you can see, we are highly dependent on fees and federal funds, and those are our stressors. In most of our programs, we have had no increases in fees over the past several years, and in our federal funding, we have received generally flat funding, and we are being told that in the president's proposed budget that there may be cuts, not huge cuts, but cuts primarily in the emergency medical services area around trauma and children's issues.
Thank you very much. You've made several references, I think, both of you, to the federal budget situation. And maybe this is a question for staff. At what point in this process did we, granted the federal budget has its own life, but, you know, if we lose some federal dollars in some of these programs, at what point is that going to even rebalance if there's a reduction at the federal level, and do we reassess how that affects existing programs? I'm just, maybe this is a John question.
Madam Chair and Representative Kotek, We generally deal with that in a reshoot or a rebalance. If we have fairly definitive indication that the budget is going to be changed, the references to the federal budget at this point, I think many of them have been the president's proposed budget. Well, that's a long way down the road, so it's not real likely that we would recommend making adjustments to this budget based on what the president has proposed at this point.
Has that been an issue in the past? Because there's a lot of federal dollars that flow through this division, and
yes.
It starts off at the beginning of the budget cycle, we're looking at zero, but...
Madam Chair and Representative Kotek, it is an issue, and a prime example, not so much related to public health at all, is the Medicaid match rate. We have pretty good indication of what it's going to be, but last time we didn't get it right, and the difference in the match rate was huge and caused a rebalance issue.
Representative Morgan?
Well, I appreciate Mr. Britton's comments, but my recollection is that the Medicaid match rate that we actually applied was really quite close to what finally happened, but because of the amount of dollars involved, it turned out to be a large adjustment that was needed in the budget. But in terms of the percentages, there was a very small difference in the percentages. So this is far from an exact science, and I think that as you move through the budgeting process over the course of the biennium, you'll see how we have to make corrections often to adjust for changes in caseloads, changes in the overall economy, changes in federal regulations and reimbursement rates. It's a very common thing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So the questions come
up after
that?
No, Mr. Britton, you may want, I don't know the exact number, you can help us with this. You know, our federal match rate is based on our level of poverty. What's one percentage point equal at this point?
Chair Carter and Senator Bates, I don't know, but it's huge.
It's a huge number.
And Representative Morgan alluded to the fact that we were off by a small percentage.
Less than a percent.
But
a lot less than a percent.
Big dollars when we're off.
Multiplied by. Mm-hmm.
So either way, we can be off in a good way too. So
a good way also means we have more poverty, so that's a bad way. But
yeah.
Madam Chair.
Oh, sorry.
In going through these budgets, is this a high level overview today? And we're going to spend more time in public health. What is our plan?
We have two more days in public health today. You can ask questions today, and two other days. Hopefully, we'll be working this budget by next Tuesday.
We're going to go through this in about 3 days then.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So I need you to prepare your questions. You can send them to John in advance so that we can have a good idea in terms of the direction in which we're going and questions and concerns that you might have. That's why I was saying please feel free to ask questions as we go, because you might want to dig down a little deeper in looking at your notebooks and ask some questions even though they are presenting on a higher level.
Madam Chair,
Senator, can you wait just for one moment? Representative Boone's hand or something.
Well, I just want to say I'm really concerned. I mean, I'm concerned about the whole budget, but particularly the piece about emergency preparedness, because that's another area that I'm working really closely too with Dr. Allen and Dr. Higginson. And if we're local health departments and local counties and entities are going to be responsible for their emergency responses, and we're getting cut and cut and cut from the federal level, and we're experiencing the timber receipt problem in many of the counties, I'm not sure. I mean, I know it's going to happen, but I'm not sure we want to go there at this point without a little more information, and I'm not sure when we're going to get that. And that's what concerns me, because as far as the you don't know that much about the federal end and your end, but I know that when the county timber receipts drop, the states are going to pick up those services, and the state is going to pick up those services. We're just talking about Oregon. Well, yeah, and I know you're saying, I'm just saying that's the next level where it goes. But, I mean, that being said, we're hearing all kinds of very frightening things from there, but all that aside, we're being asked to prepare our state for emergencies that are going to be very expensive, and especially when we're talking about human lives and property, and we're dumping this all on Dr. Allen and Ken Murphy, and you know, we're trying to scramble as hard as we can to help them with some funding because they've been cut so dramatically and they have not been funded. I mean, how can you be cut and at the same time not funded? But there's very little thought process at that level, and I think we're just like ostriches if we don't address it as soon as possible. And it sounds like you're kind of stuck with what you've got, but what will we know?
And Chair Carter and Representative Boone, this might be a good time to go into our major policy option package for EMS and trauma systems, and the description of the program starts on page 29. Because of time, I'm not going to spend much time there other than just to give you a little bit of a scope of the program. We currently certify over 9,000 EMTs, and we license over 600 hospitals and, ambulances and 150 ambulance services, and conduct about 150 complaint investigations per year. We do have some real concerns about the EMS and trauma system in Oregon, and 15 years ago, the National Highway Traffic and Safety Administration came out to take a look at our EMS and trauma system. And at the time, they were very impressed and said, particularly looking at your trauma system, you have systems and services here in the state of Oregon that the rest of the country should be trying to emulate. And we have had a lot of reductions in the way of resources to our program at the state level over the past 15 years. And because of concerns about the status of the program, we asked NHTSA to come out again and do a reassessment. They came out in March of last year and found not anywhere close to what they had seen before. They said that Oregon had really lost ground, that they now saw a fragmented, variable, non-system, that there was great variation in resources across the state, with rural and frontier areas suffering the most. And while they applauded the work that was being provided by the actual providers at the scene and on the streets, they said that there really is inadequate state-level leadership and vision to move EMS and trauma systems forward. They came up with a lengthy report, 40 pages, 66 recommendations in 11 program areas. We said this is great stuff, but we need to get an Oregon view on this. So we pulled together what we called the advisory team for EMS and trauma to take a look at those recommendations. And what they said is that this all is good work, but we think we need to focus on five major areas. One is vision and leadership and making sure that the state-level program takes responsibility for moving these issues forward. The second one is medical direction. We've always had an administrator for the program, but never a medical director, and we need to have that not only to help come up with the best protocols, but to be working with local agencies and local EMS medical directors to make sure that those are being promulgated across the state. But there's governance issues, making sure that we have good, solid advisory committees that the program actually listens to. The fourth area was in evaluation and quality improvement. They said we need to have a comprehensive, robust data system, and not only do we need to collect those data, but we need to make sure we're using those data to drive our quality improvement activities at both the state and the local level. And then finally, they said, as Representative Boone mentioned, we need to make sure that there's this real link between emergency medical services and trauma and the other preparedness activities that are taking place both in public health and with emergency management. So what we did after we got that report back is develop a legislative concept that really was trying to focus on those five areas. That is now Senate Bill 162, and it's going to be heard tomorrow afternoon in the Joint Committee on Emergency Preparedness and Ocean Policy. But we've also, since that bill came out, been working closely with our advisory committees, with the fire medical administrators, with the Oregon Fire Chiefs, the State Ambulance Association, the EMS Medical Directors Forum, Hospital Association, and others to come up with the best bill that we possibly can. So two Thursdays ago, the 22nd, we had a group of 20 stakeholders around the table working on possible amendments and have come up with 19 pages worth of amendments, which we do think is really getting us closer to the kind of bill that we need to have. The policy package itself is on page 33.
I have to tell you guys, I am really, really concerned about our lack of protocols in terms of the funding piece as it relates to any emergency, any catastrophic event we have in the state. We don't have the money allocated in any way, and I worry about coastal funds where we don't have the dollars available in that area, and when we think about cutting state funds to local communities, and then what happens to trauma, what happens to ambulance, and those kind of issues. But let me put a comment there for a minute after a question from from Senator Wardley.
My comment is more around for the good of the order, if I may, and maybe a point of personal privilege as well. My concern goes back to a comment that I heard from Dr. Allen at the very beginning of her presentation, where she said that our public health system is not as strong as it should be, and that's as a result of long-term funding reductions, failing to keep up with population needs, and then there were some other comments as well. And then I heard in Dr. Higginson's presentation, which we're kind of rushing through, that a part of the responsibility of your program area is to regulate acute care facilities, community-based providers, all with an eye toward making sure that high-quality care is being provided out there. And then that leads me to question, well, how much capacity do we really have out there to do that job and to do it well? Again, going back to Dr. Allen's earlier comment about our sorely lacking public health system. And so that leads me to question, are we giving enough time to this overall area, public health area, if we're just going to assign a couple of days to it? It just seems like we're moving too quickly and that we are high level. I understand we're all going to do our homework, we're going to read more, we're going to put forth questions and all of that. But if our system, if our public health system is in trouble, and that's what I'm hearing from Dr. Allen, we better spend more time understanding what that means in terms of where's the capacity lacking, what do we need to do to shore that up, and have a bit more robust conversation that it seems we're planning to do, Madam Chair. And I say that with all due respect. I'm just concerned that we're really moving quickly, and we're going to miss some things.
And Senator Carter and Senator Gordley, I apologize for rushing through this so quickly. I was told I needed to be done by 2:30. And one reason I do need to be done by 2:30 is that given that you just have two other days to go through another five offices, I think it's really critical that they get their amount of time as well.
And I'm not asking you to apologize. My concern is not really directed toward you. I'm asking us to take a look at our process and, you know, how do we slow it down and make sure that, again, this is public health. And an element of public health is emergency preparedness, as Representative Bloom was pointing out. And I just want to make sure that we take time to dot the I's and cross the T's carefully and fully understand where the capacity gaps are. And given that we're going to lose those timber payments and we have a county that says they can't do the job anymore, what does that mean? What do we need to put in the breach to help them out? And where does that conversation take place if it doesn't take place here?
Senator Gordy, I will promise you I just got to be talking with Mr. Britton to see if I can find some time with the two of you to further talk about the gaps. And but we can't talk about the gaps without talking about resources. And right now, ladies and gentlemen, the resources are not with us. And but it is good to have it on record. And so for that reason, Mr. Britton will make some time with my schedule for me to talk with each of you to further talk about the gaps. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 29, the description of the system refers to systems that provide emergency care to victims of sudden illness or traumatic injury, ensures that responders are fully trained, emergency vehicles are properly equipped, and so forth. From one town or county to another, the first responder may be someone in a police or sheriff's vehicle. It may be a fire truck and not an ambulance. So I'd like to understand a little better how all the activities that happen, as described here, relate to DPSST, which is public safety standards and training, which also has relationships with training what we call first responders. So how does it sort itself out, what DPSST does and what this agency ensures?
Chair Carter and Representative Nathanson, there's actually a couple of levels of first responders. There's first responders who just have basic first aid, and virtually every person in fire and every police officer has that kind of first responder training. There's another level of first responder that is a certified first responder who has actually gone through a training course that's usually provided at the local agency that gives them more training so that they're able to respond to those cases and treat those patients until a EMT or an ambulance arrives on scene to transport and treat that patient. So all of the issues around training, education for first responders in their role as to providing medical care or health care is something that's regulated by our office, whereas all of their other functions, whether it be police or fire, will be regulated through those agencies.
I think I'll follow up separately. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Ms. Madam Chair. The issue around the training for first responders is a very different one in the rural areas of the state than it is in the urban areas. In my legislative district, I have fire districts that are staffed with volunteers that also are the first responders, and so the ambulances are also staffed with volunteers. And one of the chronic issues that they have, and it's becoming more pronounced over time, is that with the increased training requirements that are put on the volunteers, it requires more and more of their time, and so you get people that just are not willing to make the investment and take time away from their families and the little bit of spare time that they have after they do all of their work and their family stuff. And I just wonder what the discussions are in this area, because I know that I routinely talk to people that run ambulance districts, and the problems that they face around getting people to be available 24 hours a day that meet the state standards, and also the problems of keeping up with the requirements for more and more sophisticated equipment are huge issues to them, and it's a burden that is potentially going to sink a lot of those volunteer organizations, and there is no taxing base capacity to start up some kind of publicly funded entity.
Chair Carter and Representative Morgan, this is an issue that we do hear a lot, and like you say, particularly from rural and frontier agencies. A couple things. One is that I think that it's critically important that we keep a standard of care across the entire state. So I don't think that what we should be talking about is reducing the level of standards for individuals who are providing these critical services, because whether I get injured in Portland or sick out in Duver, you know, it's important for me to get that same level of care. So what we need to do is work at figuring out how do we get training out to people where they live and work so that it is much easier for them to do that. And actually, the policy package does address that to some extent. We have two mobile training units at the current time. We would increase a mobile training unit and another trainer. We also would be hiring a training coordinator, and one of the responsibilities of that feedback coordinator will be working on distance learning issues to, again, try to push the training out to local agencies so that there's not such a time commitment for them to come and get trained elsewhere.
I have a follow-up. I'm not quite sure that I see the benefit of what you're doing, because currently the bulk of the training that goes on is through the community college system. And so there is already an existing training entity and process, there is a system there to provide the training. The issue is around the time, the amount of time that's required for people to be in training. And what I don't hear, what I hear is that there's going to be more training and we're going to deliver it to your door, not that we're going to somehow try to make this training deliver it in a more efficient way over all of the training and cut down on the burdens from that perspective. I'm just looking for more clarity on this.
Yeah. Senator Carter and Representative Morgan, I do think that this is one place where having that training coordinator would help to try to figure out some of those issues. But just to be clear on education and training responsibilities, community colleges are responsible primarily for the initial training of EMTs, whether that be basic, intermediate, or paramedic. After someone has been certified, at that point they have continuing education requirements, and that's the place where our mobile training units spend time going out to the actual agencies and providing those kinds of educational programs, because it's at the agency level where most of that training takes place.
Well, I would appreciate, I look forward to having this discussion with you, because there are, I think, ongoing requirements for recertification in a number of different areas if you serve as both an EMT and a firefighter. And it's the overall burden. It's one little piece and another little piece and then another piece and another piece being added to it that's causing the problems. And so there does, I think, need to be a discussion around the comprehensive picture of the time demands that are made on people that volunteer their time to do this, and it needs to be looked at in a systemic way.
And Chair Carter and Representative Morgan, I agree, but also remember that some of these drivers are not coming from the state, but they're coming from the national level. And one thing that Oregon is trying to do, and we get a push from the industry on this, is to have our state be a national certification state. And the National Registry of EMT, Emergency Medical Technicians, is going to higher standards. Actually, they have higher standards than we have right now in recertification. And are going to higher standards. So, there is a push to make sure that people who are providing that care are highly qualified and can care for people adequately. And like I said, what we need to do is make sure that we get the training out there and, as you say, have it be in a coordinated way so it's as little burden as possible on the providers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Switching gears, and this is more of a comment and question for also the good of the order. We're now looking at budgets that designate certain policy option packages to come out of the increased tobacco tax revenue. And I know we have the option to go outside of the governor's budget on what items we would like to see general fund funded. How are we handling, are we just going to set aside the fact that it's connected with the tobacco tax and potentially move forward budgets because we think that these items have priority? I'm just curious how we're going to handle that at this stage.
It is my hope, Representative Kotak, that I'm still counting on the tobacco tax and hoping that that's going to happen. Because I can't think anything differently, because to think anything differently means that we cut. We do more cuts. And
well, we don't make the investments that we need to be making.
That's exactly right. And so I'm still very hopeful that the tobacco tax will pass so that we can fund some of these services, because it would hurt my heart very much if we have to cut partnerships with the counties who are already suffering completely if we don't have the general fund dollars to help keep our commitment along those lines. And so the tobacco tax dollars are the dollars that we're depending upon to do those things.
Can I follow up? Yes. Well, I'm wondering if, and I've seen some lists, but I'm wondering if for the edification of the committee that we can have just a summary of the items in public health that are connected with the tobacco tax, so people know that. I mean, you can see that in the various sections here, but if we just had a list, then we have a sense of the impact if that wasn't going to pass connected to those particular programs.
Okay. I'll work with Mr. Britton, and we will see if we can have that information for you. I don't know about tomorrow, since so many other things are going on, but at least by Monday for sure.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Williams, and then Senator Bates.
I'd like to flip back to what Representative Morgan was talking about. And when this all started, I heard loud and clear from my local fire departments, my husband being a chief, and I'm on that particular medical team, as to the time frame, and we've talked about this too with Dr. Higginson. And what I'd really like to see is maybe even think about a regional mobile unit so that you don't have just the two trying to do the whole state, because this is really important, and he explained it really clearly. You do the initial training at the community college level, and people choose their level they want to go to. But it's, any way you look at it, it's 2 to 3 nights a week, 3 hours a night. In most areas, community college is a ways away, so you're talking 3 hours, 4 hours out, twice a week, plus your training, which is 2 to 3 hours a week, plus your 24/7 call, and you never know how bad it's going to be. So all that being said, what Representative Morgan said is absolutely true. These people are going, whoa, enough already. I'm just a volunteer. I don't get paid. We're trying to get a tax credit for some of the EMS workers. This is something we're working on, as a matter of fact, upstairs right now in a work group. But it would be helpful when we have to do the continuing education. Right now you're limited to the highest level trained volunteer department in your area and try to tag on to their training days. So you might have your drill. Everybody has drill on Wednesday night, maybe Tuesday or something. So you might be looking at giving up Thursday. Okay, so you would have maybe 2 nights a week for that on top of everything else. So my point being is it's been great so far, and I just want to make sure it holds true that so we get training through another department, as long as their level of trainer is, it's usually one of your people. And we can use that as a drill, so to speak, because a lot of the requirements require you to drill so many hours or attend 50% of your drills in order to be able to drive the equipment, for that matter. But I would love to see you do a regional approach and have like North Coast, Lower Coast, Middle, up East Side, down East Side, and then they can relate to what needs to be done in a more effective manner.
Let me put a lot on your plate at one time. Senator Bates, and then we can
just manage those two. We need to leave. I'll wait till tomorrow. Bring my points forward.
Okay. All right.
Well, and Chair Carter and Representative Boone, we are trying to do things regionally, and actually our two MGUs, one is on east of the mountains and the other one is based southern Oregon. But we just now have the resources to do two. If we had more resources, we could have more regions.
You can find me, Madam Chair, just add a comment. Again, as someone who's looking at this and somewhat with new eyes, what's been so striking is that there has not been a central system for this kind of plan, for collecting the issues that you're identifying, and for a constructive way to at least minimize the burden, maximize the quality and service. So the individual issues county by county are quite compelling, and what the proposal that that Grant is talking about would bring is a centralized forum that says, let's look at the state of the art across the country, let's at least see how other places are coping with this, and get it down so that we can balance, people deserve quality. Just because you live in a remote area doesn't mean you should get a second-tier quality of EMS services. I know nobody's suggesting that. So there are creative ways that we can learn from other states and do it across the board and not leave one fire chief or one county at a time having to struggle with this on their own. These are very hard questions. One of the things that was also striking is at the same time, we're way behind in investigating complaints. This is a
program that elicits a lot of concerns. There are people out there who should not be doing this. And we're not currently adequately staffed to respond to those promptly. And we don't know, I don't know what they're doing before our staff get out there to see if this was, you know, one irate, difficult person or truly an event that endangers people. So we've got a lot of, we need to build a system that can hear and address exactly the things you're raising.
And this budget package does address both making sure that our core capacity is up to speed where it's not right now, and then also build on things like I said, with additional mobile training units and training resources.
A quick follow-up.
Yes.
More just a, you know, thank you so much for what you're doing. I wish that it could just be asking for more of that, because that is exactly what we need. And I think that will be helping to answer the same, it's the same for us that you're hearing. And I think if people know they've got the support and that it's going to put us in a position like that, because all of you guys who travel to our rural areas, should you do that, and something happens, and even Doc Bates, particularly Doc Bates, because he'll know what's happening or not, you know. And we really want to be able to, you know, give you that initial in the field care before we package you off and send you to somebody else. And thank you so much.
Dr. Higginson, we're going to continue this conversation tomorrow. So we look forward to seeing you that committee discussed.
Thank you.